So good morning, and first of all, thank you very much for giving me the chance to spend a month here at this fabulous place. The topic here looks at the nuclear many-body problem in a somewhat conceptual way, from various angles, actually. What I'd like to do is first remind you on where we stand applying perturbative chiral effective field theory approaches to nuclear thermodynamics. But perturbative always means that one has to get a feeling for convergence, the issue of convergence. And that's why I would like to try and go beyond that by using a non-perturbative technique, which offers itself as a rather efficient tool to some certain classes of processes and diagrams to all orders, and that's the functional renormalization group. Applications will be made for nuclear matter, neutron matter, and of course one always has to look out for neutron stars these days, given the fact that we have two solar mass neutron stars, which really set very strong constraints nowadays on the equation of state of dense matter. It has to be tremendously stiff to support such stars, right? And basically every extrapolation in density of the nuclear many-body problem should nowadays take that constraint into account and see whether it produces an equation of state that's stiff enough to really support a two solar mass neutron star. There is also a very interesting and ancient test case for fluctuations, as we would call them, within the frame of the functional renormalization group. And that has to do with the test of the way the pion mass changes in a nuclear medium. As I said, that's an old subject. It dates back to excellent phenomenology by the times that pionic atoms were investigated in great detail. And we have something to say about that. Perhaps the most important message that comes out of all this is about the thermodynamics of the chiral order parameter. Remember that chiral order parameter is, as an observable, the pion decay constant as it evolves with density and temperature, which is connected, of course, to the chiral condensate, the quark pair condensate in matter as a function of density and temperature. And the principal question that we always face in all these kinds of considerations is, where would the matter turn from the spontaneously broken Nambu-Goldstone realization back to the trivial Wigner-Weil realization of chiral symmetry, restoration of chiral symmetry, right? And this is where the fluctuations, the systematic treatment of fluctuations, has to say quite a bit about. Most of the considerations about chiral restoration so far have been done in mean field approximation, and I would like to demonstrate that mean field approximation is not at all good for this kind of discussion. There is nowadays a very interesting topic about how hyperons behave in neutron stars. The general issue is that if one adds hyperons into the neutron star core, the equation of state tends to become much too soft in order to still be able to support two solar mass neutron stars. And this I perhaps, if I have time, will put a little bit of an outlook, because this is ongoing research about how perhaps to prevent lambda hyperons to pop up in the center of a neutron star. Okay, I mean, at least part of our motivation here in doing this is driven by the ongoing discussion about the QCD phase diagram. I show it here in a somewhat unconventional way, pressure as a function of temperature. Usually you see temperature as a function of chemical potential, but this is also quite interesting to see, because it emphasizes in particular what we know and what we don't know. In this plot, pressure versus temperature, we know, of course, a lot about the hadronic phase, where nuclear physics is in the center, and we can just make use of the tremendously well-developed phenomenology there. There is also pretty good information nowadays about how this phase diagram behaves at high temperature, low density, really at the borderlines here, through the heavy ion experiments at the highest possible energies, and through lattice QCD data. And there is a degree of consistency reached nowadays about there being a crossover transition from the hadronic phase to the quark-gluon phase, not a phase transition, a crossover transition, and that appears to be well established. All of this, however, is pure speculation, and I will not touch it either, but I would like to discuss along the line this part of the speculation, namely whether there is a chiral first-order phase transition, which many people have been claiming in the low density, that means couple times nuclear matter density, high density, couple times nuclear matter density, and low temperature part of this diagram. And I have put two question marks already indicating that I don't quite believe in such things anymore. Okay, this is just summarizing what I said. I believe it's very important in the discussion of the QCD phase diagram, the phase diagram of strongly interacting matter, to take the nuclear physics education that we have very seriously, because it really constrains whatever we extrapolate as we go to higher densities. And here is again what I mean. This chiral phase transition, which has been kind of predicted or suggested by models. These models were mostly quark models, chiral quark models treated at the level of mean field approximation. And they came up with suggestions that there should be a first order chiral phase transition at something like 1.5 times or whatever nuclear matter density. And this, of course, is really intruding into the well-known domain, well-known terrain of nuclear physics, and that's why we should check it out coming from below, from all we know about nuclear physics.
If there's no chiral phase transition, then there is also probably no critical endpoint, right?
Sorry?
Then there is also no critical
endpoint. There is also no critical endpoint, which, as we know, has been put always into the headlines of some of the ongoing projects which are still pending, right? So I think it's appropriate to ask these questions seriously.
Yeah. Is the physical boundary, is that set by the speed of sound being less
than two? That's one thing, and generally thermodynamics, of course, determines the relation between pressure and temperature, and you can't have very low pressure when you're at very high temperature, right? Because there's a lot of stuff boiling, and that produces pressure. So it's these two things, causality on one hand, and of course just thermodynamic consistency on the other hand. So what's really needed is a systematic approach to nuclear thermodynamics, certainly beyond the mean field approximation. And indeed, chirally effective field theory has been used to discuss that in the recent years, the past decades, to quite some systematics, and that's why the first part of this talk, the first shorter part of this talk, will just be sort of a review of where we stand from the point of view of perturbative chirally effective field theory in dealing with these questions. The starting point is always confinement and spontaneous chiral symmetry breaking, right? Confinement means that quarks and gluons are not the active degrees of freedom in the area of physics that we're talking about, but rather the Goldstone bosons of spontaneously broken chiral symmetry, the pions attached to nucleons as heavy sources. And this chiral EFT is supposed to represent low energy QCD at scales below the characteristic spontaneous chiral symmetry breaking scale, 4 pi times the pi on decay constant of order 1 GeV. And then there are several strategies how to deal with the physics in this area. The most well-known nowadays is chiral effective field theory in the form of in-medium chiral perturbation theory. That's really based on the nonlinear sigma model with nucleons. And there are two versions, either with or without explicit treatment of the delta 1232, the lowest excitation of the nucleon itself. And the thermodynamics is then developed in terms of an expansion of the free energy density calculated within this framework in powers of the Fermi momentum, and that is then carried on to a certain order. The order being determined, first of all, by the order to which you go in the chiral effective Lagrangian, typically nowadays N3LO in this context, and secondly, to the number of loops that you're going to allow yourself to be calculated in building up the free energy density, typically 3 loop nowadays. The other approach, which starts at a bit higher scales, is, and that's what I would like to talk about here as well, a chiral nucleon meson model, which is based on the linear sigma model rather than the nonlinear one, with, however, a nonlinear chiral potential. Chiral potential meaning an effective potential involving the chiral fields. But the scalar field is also part of this discussion in this approach. And this is what I would like to use as a starting point to really do a non-perturbative renormalization group investigation. Perhaps thinking about or speaking about scales and schemes, one could draw here the relevant scales on the vertical axis. The physics in this context starts at the scale which I call the ultraviolet scale of this particular approach or framework, which is given by the spontaneous chiral symmetry breaking scale of about a GeV. Right? And then we would like to systematically evolve downward in scales until we reach the infrared physics, the kind of nuclear physics that we're aiming at by doing, for example, renormalization group methods. With the linear sigma model, you can start up here. That linear sigma model has basically bare nucleons, pions as Goldstone bosons, and scalar degrees of freedom, scalar field degrees of freedom. The scalar field is supposed to be very heavy as a starting point. You can think about it being somehow related, for example, to the F0 980 or so, not to the 500 MeV pole with a 600 MeV width, which is called the sigma sometimes in nuclear phenomenology. This is very important to keep these things apart. Once one reaches down to scales at which momentum and energy are small compared to this scalar mass, one can integrate out the scalar mass, and this is the way how to go from the linear sigma model to a nonlinear sigma model, well known.
But which scalar mass are you talking about? Now you're talking about the 500.
No, this is not the 500. This is the 700 or 800 or 900 MeV mass, which is integrated out, right?
If you look at the scale.
No, this means small compared. I mean, here you have the M sigma is somewhere up here, right? And I'm talking about scales at which I apply chiral effective field theory, which are small compared to either one of these scales. Right? That's what I have in mind. That's in fact important. In this case, I mean, you can turn from a linear sigma model to a nonlinear sigma model basically by a unitary transformation of the fields. It's known since the 60s how to do that. Read it in Barry's book or Weinberg's book. And then you end up with dressed nucleons, chiral nucleons, which are already surrounded in a way by pion fields, and the sigma has disappeared, has been integrated out as an explicit degree of freedom, and then you end up with a nonlinear sigma model as the basis of the further discussion. There is nowadays also one step further, which is what's called the VLOK approach, low momentum chiral interaction approach, which is a bit like pion-free effective field theory in the sense that you construct a potential which is now representing the physics at very low momentum scales, and you can do a quite good low energy nuclear physics with that as well. But I'm not going to touch this. I will concentrate on these two parts here.
So why do you need these models in the first place?
Sorry?
Why do you need these models in the first place?
Oh, because I want to do some physics. Well, you want to start from QCD? Good luck. No, why?
What is the reason, for example, why you need to couple an explicit scalar to be?
Oh, because if you're thinking in terms of scales, right? If you want to start up here, that's really the place where spontaneous chiral symmetry breaking has been taking place. Then you are at scales in which something like the scalar still plays a role in principle, because it has a mass of the same order as the chiral symmetry breaking scale. Right?
So then why don't you need to include the explicit vector meson, say?
Oh yeah, I'm going to talk about that. This will come in addition. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But
just wait a little.
Is it important that you start off with something that's renormalizable? Is
that
going
to
play a role?
That used to be a big theme, of course, when I was young. But as I grew older, that stopped being such a big theme. And nowadays, we know, of course, that basically everything we can deal with are effective field theories, and they are not necessarily subject to some of these effective field theories are, of course, subject to renormalizability, but it's not such a key element anymore, right? This is renormalizable, this is not renormalizable, but we know how to deal with this anyway, right? Okay, well, just to remind you, the chirally effective field theory then works with pions as the light and fast movers coupled to nucleons as the heavy and slow sources, and you have this systematic hierarchy of interaction terms that you can put to whatever order you can afford to put it. I mean, nowadays the nucleon-nucleon interaction based on this has reached N4LO, right? And even some of the dominant pieces of N5LO have been checked out so that one gets a certain feeling about the convergence of this. And here, of course, as always, short distance dynamics is encoded in contact terms with corresponding constants in front of them. That you have seen so many times that I don't have to talk about it much anymore. This is the hierarchy of interactions in the two-body, two-nucleon sector. Three nucleon forces come at N2LO, four nucleon forces come at N3LO, and this is, I guess, the level of sophistication that has been reached nowadays in this problem. But I always like to remind myself and others that there is this, one of the key questions in all of this is, to what extent do you know, or do you have to know, some information about the intrinsic properties of the nucleon itself, right? At the scales that are relevant here to be dealt with. And that's, of course, where the delta isobar, the delta resonance, pops out very prominently, because it is separated only by 300 MeV, just about twice the pion mass from the nucleon ground state, and that's a small scale. And whatever small scale there is in the problem should be treated explicitly, if possible, right? And this is at least in part of the calculations that have been done, particularly our own calculations here, that has been done. The delta can be treated as an explicit degree of freedom. And it's interesting because getting the delta involved immediately gives you a handle about half of the strength of the two pi in exchange force, which is the most important part of the nuclear force in the nuclear many-body problem. And that really looks like a kind of a screened van der Waals force at intermediate ranges. At intermediate distances, say between 1 and 2 Fermi or so, it can in fact be represented in our space even by this simple form here. The 1 over r to the 6th reminds you that there is sort of a van der Waals kind of process involved. Of course, it is screened by two pion masses, and then there is a polynomial in the dimensionless n pi r. But what it also tells you immediately is that if this is a prominent process, then there will be a prominent, strong three-body force in a space in which you include explicitly nucleons and deltas. This would not be called a three-body force, by the way. This would just be called an iterated two-body force in the space of nucleons and deltas. So it's also very important when one discusses three-body forces to keep this in mind. What is the space of active degrees of freedom? One can integrate out the delta, and then, of course, you have a genuine three-body force, which comes usually at N2LO, but with explicit treatment of deltas, this can be promoted to NLO, right? This is, I think, what Yevgeny also has been discussing quite some time ago. Right?
I think one should be maybe careful because actually, in this approach, they can still integrate it out of the human space. We do a couple of child calculations, but it's included in the level of the effective.
That's right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's an effective degree of freedom of the effective for the margin.
Right.
At the end of the day, you solve the Schrodinger equation based on nucleons.
Yes, this is.
For one can do even better, one can do even better.
Right.
In
some of the perturbative calculations we did, for example, in Munich, I mean, this was really treated as kind of a Feynman diagram in the medium, and that's where you would call it an explicit treatment of the delta. Okay, just to summarize the situation as it stands, I think it's that I don't have to say here in this room. The important new element that was really brought in by this chiral effective field theory is, I think, the very explicit and accurate treatment of two pi exchange forces. This is the most important thing. Of course, there are many other important things, but this is the leading part of the nucleon-nucleon interaction responsible for dealing with the nuclear many-body problem. And then there are contact terms and three-body forces. Just for amusement, just a short digression. If we hadn't yet known this from all our nuclear physics history, the two-pion exchange force would have been discovered not so long ago at LHC, at very high energies in extremely peripheral proton-proton scattering at 8 TeV. Right? I mean, the standard description that our high-energy colleagues use for ages is the Pomeron exchange, which produces this exponential behavior here of the differential cross-section. But you see nowadays, I mean, it's very accurate, you see nowadays a significant deviation from this exponential behavior just in ranges of momentum transfer T, which correspond to two pion exchange, right? And this is really interpreted as seeing the two pion exchange at LHC. Okay, this is a historical picture here, dated back to the early days of our involvement in this topic. It's the energy per particle as a function of density, the equation of state at temperature zero of nuclear matter. With next to leading order chi pt, times have passed over this level of the discussion nowadays, but it was very useful to do it anyway This is calculating the energy density up to three loops, and it includes explicit deltas, so what we just talked about. I call it three-body. Even here it is in fact iterated two-body, but in your language it is three-body. And you see the role of three-body forces here, turning them on and off in conjunction with the Pauli principle acting on intermediate nucleon state, in playing this very important role of first stabilizing, of course, nuclear matter, and secondly, making it stiff as you go up in density. I think this is a result that can still hold. Yeah.
When you are talking about medium KPTs, so I wonder whether you can make contact to vacuum, so to the normal formulation, especially what concerns short range interactions.
Yes, well, that comes right next. I mean, here the contact terms are simply fixed basically to produce this minimum. But in the next slide, I guess that's the state of the art where you really make contact to the improved nucleon-nucleon interactions at the same time, which are fitted to phase shift, and you know that much better than I do. This is N3LO, chiral NN interactions with N2LO three-body forces included. That's about the state of the art of dealing with a many-body problem. The two-body problem has advanced even further, but for the many-body problem, this is a very good starting point already.
And there's no fine-tuning, or is there fine-tuning involved with the cutoff parameter?
No, there is no fine-tuning involved anymore. You just start.
Before there was, right? I mean, what you showed before.
The one before was much more elementary in the sense that the contact terms, there are two contact terms, right? Leading order next to leading order. And they have simply been fitted in order to reproduce this point here. Right? And then you extrapolate. These calculations here are more advanced in the sense that you use an NN interaction and three-body forces as an input and then go ahead, right, in the nuclear many-body problem. Right? This is, some people call that ab initio.
But what is about the convergence? I mean, you're getting high in momentum, right?
This is a very good point, and this is what I would like to come to when I switch gears to non-perturbative methods. Right? Here, the degree of uncertainty as you go to higher densities, you can follow that up to about twice nuclear matter density. The degree of uncertainties that are involved are roughly given by the differences between these pairs of curves, right? These two curves differ by using different cutoffs. One is 400 and the other one is 450 or so. Of course, you won't notice any such differences in the low density region where the Fermi momentum is low, but as you go further up, you will encounter such uncertainties, and these are the uncertainties that you still live with, yeah.
These are in-medium calculations.
These are in-medium calculations, yeah.
In principle, if I would be able to solve thermodynamics, let's say based on bottom interactions using some many-body technique, which I don't have, but in principle, if I would be able to do so,
exactly with that. In fact, that is precisely how it's done, right? You start with your vacuum input. The low energy constants are fixed in the vacuum at the two-body level, and you have some idea about three-body forces. The three-body forces have been fit to three-body problems, helium-3 triton. And then you go ahead and systematically do what the condensed matter people call Kohn-Luttinger-Ward many-body perturbation theory. Right? You go step by step, order by order in the number of loops that you include here, and in medium loops. Right? And this is done to second order here, not very far. Mm-hmm. But it already gives you, well, a picture of the nuclear phase diagram, including the liquid gas phase transition and such things. This is the same scheme applied to neutron matter. And you see here, this black curve corresponds to the black curves, the solid curves over here, going to neutron matter. And this shaded area gives you the impression of the state-of-the-art estimates of uncertainties. This comes from the Darmstadt group here. Hilger, Hebeler, Schwenk, and company, also at N3LO. Here you have, for comparison, some quantum Monte Carlo results. People are discussing why there are such differences. I can't really comment much on it at this moment. At least at very low densities, the agreement is remarkably good. And that's, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what is the two dots, the shaded dot and the open
dot? Oh, these are, oh yeah, I should have said more about this. This really, as I mentioned, represents the kind of van der Waals-like phase diagram which incorporates the nuclear liquid gas phase transition. And here you have the coexistence, the liquid gas coexistence region in this phase diagram. And this is the critical point. And the fact that one is open and one is full dotted is just, again, the difference between two different cutoffs, 400 and 450 MeV, which make no difference, of course, to this critical point here, because that's sort of a low density phenomenon, low momentum characteristics. Okay, so this is about where we stand, and many groups are doing this nowadays, in particular the Darmstadt group here usually does a much more careful, even, and I should say also more conservative estimate of uncertainties, which is very useful to have. But we see that there is a high degree of consistency between at least the groups that do this perturbative chirally EFT at the same level. So now let me switch gears and come to the major part, second part of my talk, namely getting the functional renormalization group involved in basically starting a scale evolution up here, right at the place where spontaneous chiral symmetry breaking sets in. So that's where you switch from quarks and gluons up here to mesons and baryons down here, and then you evolve further down. You evolve further down, and using the functional renormalization group then allows you really to iterate to some processes to all orders that are appearing in the chiral EFT, the perturbative chiral EFT approach to some order, right? Like N3LO, second order in the many body problem, and such things. And the interesting question, of course, is, can we say something by doing this systematically about the convergence properties of the chiral EFT, perturbative chiral EFT, up to a point, right? We would be able to carry this kind of strategy to probably much higher densities than what we would allow ourselves to do with the perturbative chiral EFT. And so the question is, is there some correspondence between the two, and how far does it carry? Okay, perhaps just to remind you, that's probably not necessary, but let me do it anyway, that in the center of the discussion now is the notion of the effective action. The effective action is generated with some Lagrangian, in our case this chiral meson nucleon Lagrangian. You do Matsubara formalism in order to introduce temperature and generate an action. The action will depend on fields representing the active degrees of freedom. It will depend on temperature, and it will depend on chemical potentials. And if the effective action is given, then one can use it to really produce inverse propagators as such, by taking derivatives with respect to the fields, and you can of course go on and generate correlation functions of higher order as much as derivatives you would like to take. Okay, then from the effective action, one can generate a grand canonical potential by looking at the minimum of this effective action, where the fields are numbers then, expectation values. And once one has a grand canonical potential, one can do the whole thermodynamics. This is the logics behind that. But the real question is, of course, how to calculate, how to generate such an effective action. And this is where the functional renormalization group comes in. The functional renormalization group deals with a scale-dependent action, where one introduces a scale regulator and adds it to the action here in producing the partition function, from which in turn one can produce this k-dependent action. And this scale regulator has the property of focusing on a certain range of scales when evolving from ultraviolet to infrared. Right? And this is how it looks like. It works. It works. This scale regulator works like a cutoff as a function of momentum squared around some scale k squared. And the derivative of that really focuses on this, let's call it resolution scale that you're interested in. And then there is Wetterich's functional renormalization group flow equations, which tell how the action changes as we change that scale k. This is a functional differential equation, and it involves, well, this k-dependent action, that's what you're after. And it has here the derivative of this regulator function in the numerator, so this is where one focuses on a certain scale window, a narrow scale window, and in the denominator it has the second derivative of the action here. The second derivative, remember, corresponds to the full propagator of whatever degree of freedom propagates, right? Is involved. And that is modified here by the regulator, which acts a little bit like a mass term in this energy denominator corresponding to the propagators. This looks simple and looks a bit schematic, but in practice, of course, it's a very complicated set of equations, matrix functional differential equations. The trace here includes all the degrees of freedom involved, also includes momentum integrations. The, in practice, a nice regulator that is systematically used in this context is the Littim regulator, which has a step function here in the regulator itself, and that means it involves a delta function in the derivative, and that's where you really focus. It's like scanning through the resolution scales when you then start from the original action here at the ultraviolet scale. That's our chiral spontaneous chiral symmetry breaking scale of order of a GeV. And then the Wetterich's flow equations take you down to the infrared, and by the time you reach very low scales, long wavelength scales, you have reached the level of the effective action, right, that you're interested in dealing with your physics problem. So this is very often represented in this innocently looking one loop structure here, but there is a lot of physics going in here because these are the full propagators of all the degrees of freedom involved, and here is the scale regulator. Okay, so now back to our model, chiral model, of course. To start with, at the ultraviolet scale, the spontaneous symmetry breaking scale, and as I said, we start from a model that has the structure of a linear sigma model to start with a highly nonlinear potential involving the chiral fields. The chiral fields are the scalar field and the pion field. In order to deal with short distance physics, we introduce vector fields, but not in the sense of putting in rho mesons or omega mesons. That's really not what we want in this context. What we simply want is to represent the short distance dynamics in this nuclear physics problem, the things that are otherwise parametrized in chiral effective field theory by contact terms. Right? We want to generate them from a Lagrangian here. Right? And even though you see here mass terms and coupling strength and even field tensors, the field tensors in the end won't matter very much because we start out by saying that the mass of the vector particles is again very large, of order 900 MeV or so. So they will not introduce strong fluctuations as you evolve your scales downward to the infrared domain. And in fact, in the end, it's enough to treat these short distance degrees of freedom at the mean field level without fluctuations. And that's where, you know, from good old Malechka mean field, relativistic mean field theory, that it's not the coupling strength and the masses that enter separately. It's only the ratios of coupling strength squared divided by mass squared, which are then kind of representing the low energy constants associated with contact terms in the chiral effective field theory version of this. But the sigma we would like to keep, I mean, first of all, for reasons of chiral symmetry, as long as we are at relatively high scales, high K scales. And if they want to be integrated out as we evolve to lower scales, that will happen all by itself by solving the functional renormalization group flow equations. Okay? And then one should end up in principle with a chiral effective field theory, which has only pion degrees of freedom, but highly non-linearly coupled through derivative terms.
So the mass term for the chiral would be positive?
Sorry, the?
The mass term for
sigma. Oh, that's included in here. Through derivatives of this potential with respect to the field.
But derivatives of sigma and pi in the potential.
There are no derivatives other than the kinetic ones here in this potential.
So this will not completely reproduce chiral perturbation theory, right?
Well, you will if you
you will produce terms of the sigma, but not the coefficients in general.
I think if you integrate out the sigma boson here, and if you do that very systematically, you will end up producing derivative terms, at least the leading ones that you get also in the chiral.
Yeah, but I mean, not with the coefficients, right? I mean, that was.
Well, coefficients should come out of this, right? I mean, you start out with constants, which are. Inserted here at the level of this model, and then these constants will carry through, right? And you will express in the end.
Yeah, but the nonlinear sigma model is built. I mean, if you would take infinitely, let's restrict first to the pion sector because that's simple. Mm-hmm. The pion sector is no complicated. If you watched. You would describe all the low energy physics because you can take infinitely many terms. I mean, you have everything in there. It's just symmetry.
Yes, yes.
But the sigma model is more than that. It has some specific dynamics.
Correct.
So it will not produce, it will not have the possibility to catch all the physics because it's dynamically restricted.
No, you see, I mean, in the end, of course, it becomes a quantitative question. Let's just look at pi-pi scattering from these two points of view, because that has been dealt with in the
60s. Yeah, but
of
course, leading order, yeah.
No. This is very tricky. It's very tricky. I mean, the linear sigma model as such would not offer itself to do a perturbative calculation. of pion nucleon or pion pion scattering. You would have to go to very, very high orders to cancel certain terms which come with different signs and which, this is well known from the old times. The nonlinear sigma model is much, much more efficient in doing that because you will pick up a few leading orders and already produce the T matrix, right? So there is no one-to-one correspondence between a perturbative expansion of the linear sigma model on one hand and chiral perturbation theory, for example.
Yeah. Stated the question, okay, sorry.
Shouldn't there at least be one of leading orders? So if I calculate pi scattering the linear sigma model at tree level, I should recover the KPT expression for the tree level pi pi amplitude.
In the linear sigma model, you have to be very careful and go a few steps further, because the leading terms, in the linear sigma model, are very large and they come with opposite signs. Okay.
Yeah, you need a couple of sigma exchange diagrams to recover.
Yes, exactly. Yep. Sigma exchange, but also fermion anti-fermion exchange. Right. This.
Let me make my question more precise. In the Weinberg theorem, right? I mean, that he stated that field theory has no content other than symmetry, etc. Is this general Lagrangian general enough to catch that, or do we need, in fact, derivative terms also of the sigmas and pions in the potential?
I don't think you need derivative terms, but you have to go to reasonably high powers of the fields in this potential. Then you can make contact, even quantitatively. But you have to go to high orders in doing the linear sigma model.
Yeah, but I mean, this model is a special case. The question is, that, is it general enough to satisfy Weinberg's theorem? And I doubt it. I mean, because it's you know, the dynamics is special.
Well, you don't have actual sources in, for example.
You don't have axial sources in. I mean, you could add them. No problem. Right?
In that sense,
I mean, if you put in all sources in all relevant physical channels that you want this model to operate in, I think you can do it. But it's of course terribly hard to do it in the linear sigma model because there will be no reasonable perturbative expansion to come close to, say, chiral perturbation theory. Right? This is well known. I mean, it's and if you look in the books, Lee's book, for example, of the 60s, you see that spelled out. You see how you go from a linear sigma model with highly non-linear potential to a non-linear representation.
In the first Gasser-Leutwieder paper, where they also discussed the linear sigma model, and they have just mentioned that it's just gives a special. I mean, you could of course go from a linear model back to a non-linear and forget a special part special coefficients, not the free coefficients. I mean, the coefficients are fixed. And then in chiral perturbation theory, coefficients are free, completely free. I mean, it's just symmetry. I mean, it doesn't need to. The whole Lagrangian could also describe some funny word, technicolor word, or whatever, where the physics repeats itself. I mean, just symmetry.
I mean, of course, what's well established is that both these approaches, linear and nonlinear sigma model, with appropriately chosen nonlinear potentials for the chiral fields, that they satisfy all the low energy theorems you know from current algebra, right? So the current algebra that comes out of this is exactly the same. And this, I think, is the key to seeing the connection, right? Okay, let me go on from here. In this way of doing things, the effective potential here, this U of sigma pi, is constructed to reproduce standard nuclear thermodynamics around equilibrium. And then once this is fixed, we go on and do the thermodynamics in a wider range. We have been quite inspired in doing this by work of the Heidelberg group, who did mean field calculations using this. And I'll show you a picture which is quite interesting in this context. But what we would like to do is produce the mesonic and nucleonic particle hole fluctuations and treat them non-perturbatively using the functional renormalization group. Right? Then we might make contact to the perturbative chiral EFT results and see how they compare in the end. Okay, here is this picture which inspired us quite a lot. This is about the chemical freeze-out curve, the universal chemical freeze-out curve that our heavy ion colleagues produce from years ago and still ongoing at LHC in the Ellis experiment. This curve, it's a T mu diagram that shows here something which is very much reminiscent of the chiral crossover transition, which you also see in lattice QCD. And people generally agree that the transition temperature here is something like 155 plus minus 3 or 5 MeV. So there is a lot of consensus about this. But there was a time when this discussion was carried on, even to low temperatures and reasonably large chemical potentials, and the freeze-out points which were produced by the people working in at Brookhaven and at CERN produced these points here, which correspond to the points where hadronization has reached the stage where interactions are turned off between the hadrons. Right? This is what's called hadronic freeze-out. And people were thinking that this could be part of the first order chiral transition line with some critical point up here carrying down to, say, the nuclear physics domain. People usually were not thinking so much about this nuclear liquid gas transition here. But using mean field approximation and with this chiral nucleon meson model applied to this problem really revealed that one could simply continue kind of this nuclear liquid gas phase transition line up to the gas region, and then these points, empirical points, would all lie on a line of constant density, which is really a small fraction, 1/10 of nuclear matter density, right? And so there is no connection whatsoever to a chiral phase transition in this region. It's all standard nuclear interacting Fermi gas physics. Okay, but we would like to go a few steps further by dealing with fluctuations. And so one thing to do is to specify the effective potential for that. This effective potential has a chirally symmetric part expressed in terms of the chiral field, chiral fields, that is the sigma field, the pi field. I call it chi here. This is the invariant combination of those. And the potential is then represented in terms of a power series, power expansion in powers of this chi. We go to fourth order in chi, which seems to be sufficient for all purposes of what we're doing. And then there is an explicit chiral symmetry breaking piece here. This is nothing but the transcription of the quark mass term in the QCD Lagrangian, right, to pionic language. So this sigma here, if you take the expectation value, then has a connection to the chiral condensate, if one wants to write it out. Now, I already mentioned this scalar sigma field that has a mean field and fluctuating pieces. The mean field is in fact the chiral order parameter. So when we see changes of this mean sigma field as a function of temperature, and chemical potential, then this is equivalent to talking about the change of the pion decay constant as a function of temperature and chemical potential. Because the vacuum expectation value of the sigma field is simply defined to be the pion decay constant. Okay. So this is one thing. The other thing is that the sigma mass here that I mentioned already should not be identified with this sigma 500 pole, which appears when you do the pi-pi scattering problem in the spin isospin S-wave isospin zero channel, because this pole would anyway be generated explicitly by carrying this model to sufficiently high order, calculating the pi-pi T matrix. So our sigma mass is really something of the order of 800 MeV, close to what you could call the F-naught 900 or whatever. The nucleon mass is connected to the chiral field by what ends up, if you look at it even more carefully, being the Goldberger, the good old Goldberger-Treeman relation. This is the pion-nucleon coupling constant, right? If you get also GA involved, GA is one here, the axial vector coupling constant of the nucleon at that level of the discussion, but the nucleon mass in the Goldberger-Treeman relation would be G over GA times F pi, right? So this is already reminiscent of one of the famous chiral theorems. Vector fields, I said, encode short distance NN dynamics. They will be self-consistently determined, but we treat them only as background, as mean fields, non-fluctuating, because they are given a very large mass. There is no point letting them fluctuate. They are not to be identified with the physical omega and rho mesons. Their main role is to introduce effective chemical potentials by shifting those potentials accordingly when there is when there are non-zero expectation values of these fields. The relevant quantities here that appear in the context of these vector fields are, as I already said, kind of the mean field quantities, the coupling strength divided by the mass squared, and these can be mapped onto contact terms in the chiral effective field theory. So we have a total of, well, not so many parameters. We go to fourth order in powers of the chiral field in this potential, but the first two orders are completely determined by vacuum properties, either by pi-pi scattering or by pion-nucleon scattering. So there's no choice there. This comes in. The third and fourth order are constants which need to be adjusted, and these are two coefficients which we treat as parameters in the effective potential. One more parameter is the sigma mass, which we choose to be 800 MeV. And then there are natural sizes for these vector coupling strengths, which are very much reminiscent of contact terms as they appear in the chiral effective field theory. And then we can go ahead. We go back to Wetterich's equation. We introduce a k-dependent action. Solve Wetterich's equations, by the way, highly non-trivial procedure to do that. This is really the work of one of my former PhD students, Matthias Dreves. He put it on a lattice, right? Solved these equations on a grid, and that was the only way to do it, because standard integration techniques just won't work. It's too complex, this problem here. And for the thermodynamics, what needs to be done is really just to take the difference between the equation, between the action, the k-dependent actions at given temperature and chemical potentials, and relative to some fixed point for which we take the t equal to zero situation at normal nuclear matter in the minimum at the equilibrium chemical potential of nuclear matter. This equilibrium chemical potential is 923 MeV, by the way, just the nucleon mass minus the binding energy per nucleon.
So what approximations are made in these calculations?
Yeah, let me come to that. Of course, you have to truncate at some point. It's called an exact functional renormalization group, but that doesn't help very much, of course. It's just like limiting the space when you do Schwinger-Dyson calculations, right? So the approximations made here, let me see. Yeah, the approximations made here are the following. We take a leading term in a derivative expansion. Right? If you think of derivatives, take the leading term. So there are no higher derivatives of the chiral fields in the starting setup of the action at the ultraviolet. And we neglect the running, which could also be there, of the Yukawa coupling. Right? It could have a renormalization group running. That we also neglect. I don't think this is a big issue because lots of the vertex corrections are produced anyway, right? With these two approximations, the whole problem boils down to solving differential equations for the effective potential. There is a k-dependent potential which has an input on the right-hand side of this differential equation, which looks relatively simple. It's like a quasi-particle input with self-energies of the pion and the sigma and so forth produced or generated by derivatives of this k-dependent potential. And then you solve the differential equation and produce all the propagators as they would like to be, as they would like to evolve when you change the scale from ultraviolet to infrared. And well, this is one of the first outcomes that we get, normal nuclear matter. Of course, this is not a problem because it has been fixed by two of the coefficients in the effective potential, but this is already non-trivial. I mean, here you see how the energy per particle extrapolates as a function of density. And here you compare with rather sophisticated many-body calculations like quantum Monte Carlo and the good old variational calculation by Akmal, Pandaripande, and Ravenhall. And you see it follows this quite well. Of course, I mean, there needs to be a discussion of uncertainties. The uncertainties are at the level of the input parameters still. For example, in these third and fourth order terms in the potential. So this is the starting point, and then we can discuss thermodynamics, like the liquid gas phase transition again. And here are two ways of plotting that. Here is a T mu diagram of the nuclear liquid gas phase transition, and you see here the difference between mean field and full functional renormalization group. It's quite interesting. Maybe not so spectacular, but it's you see definitely a significant difference. Here is the same physics in a T rho plot. From here to here, you have the coexistence region, liquid gas coexistence region. Here is where normal nuclear matter really starts. Right? Out here, you have a Fermi liquid. Right? And you have critical points here. And what you see here is kind of interesting because These two curves correspond to two completely different calculations. Right? The first one is FRG, using the model I described. The second one is the chiral perturbative, chiral EFT, in the way I described it before. Right?
So I'm curious, in your calculations, full line, so the value of GA is still 1?
This is still, I guess this is a good question. I think if you look at the axial current of your nucleon, it will be renormalized because the nucleon is going to be dressed by pion fields. So this is actually a good question, and we should go for this, because of course, we can extract the axial form factor in a way or whatever of the nucleon. The nucleon starts out point-like, will be dressed by a pion cloud, and then you can ask for the normalization of that form factor at Q squared equal to zero, and the number will be GA, right? So this has never been done, but it's a good question. I think there should be a non-trivial addition to GA equal to 1, but I don't know what would be the outcome. But because in the chiral EFT, you always put that in, right? Yeah. So many things happen just along the line of this evolution of the functional renormalization group, which produce such physics as GA, but I don't know what the number is really. By the way, I mean, this of course wasn't planned like this, but some recent empirical analysis of the critical region here in the liquid gas phase diagram, using all sorts of data from multi-fragmentation and nuclear reactions, low energy nuclear reactions, put this square here as an empirical number to this. So this is not trivial. I mean, it has not been put in. Oh, by the way, yeah. Can I go on just a little bit? Here is the step from symmetric nuclear matter to asymmetric nuclear matter and further on to neutron matter. Again, looked at from the point of view of a phase diagram, including the thermodynamics. Now, the step from symmetric to asymmetric nuclear matter is completely well determined because of the isospin dependence of all the forces which involve multi-pion exchanges, plus the one constant which is attached to the isovector vector field, which controls short distance physics, not resolved in this sector. And so you can go step by step changing the proton fraction from symmetric nuclear matter, 0.5, x equal to 0.5, down to close to neutron matter, small proton fraction of the order of 5%. And you see now systematically how this critical point in the liquid gas phase diagram involves along this path here. And at some point, of course, nuclear matter stops to be self-bound. And that's where the whole liquid gas phase transition scenario just disappears, right? And you end up having neutron matter. Here is the same at zero temperature, and here you have neutron matter already, right? So there is some systematics which is quite interesting from many points of view. Let me bring up this one point which I like very much, namely talking about mean field versus the role of fluctuations. The pion mass itself is a beautiful test case. This is the story about the in-medium change of the negative pion mass, negatively charged pion mass, as you increase density or chemical potential. Phenomenology of that is well prepared from the 60s, 70s, 80s of tremendous systematics in pionic atom physics and low-energy pion nuclear scattering physics. All is history. But it all ended up with a phenomenological optical potential for the pi minus as a function of density here in symmetric nuclear matter, which has this simple representation. There is a leading order term which just involves the isospin even scattering length from pion nucleon scattering, and a next to leading order term which involves the isospin odd scattering length squared, all multiplied by density. And here you have an extra factor which comes from the propagation here of this pion between these two points, which raises the power in Fermi momentum from kf cubed to kf to the fourth if you make a Fermi momentum expansion. And from the old times of pion nuclear physics, it is well known that this potential extrapolated to normal nuclear matter density raises, if you put it in the form of a change of the mass of the pion, it's S wave, so you can relate it to a mass, it changes the mass of the pi minus by 10% upward at normal nuclear matter density. And this is exactly what you see here in this rather involved functional renormalization group result. Now, of course, you start out here at low chemical potential, having this first order liquid gas phase transition all around. So nothing changes with respect to the pion mass in this region until you meet the chemical potential appropriate for nuclear matter, and that's where the density kind of makes a jump. And here we have our nuclear matter equilibrium point, right? So here we can compare to this number, and you see it's 10%. And this is quite amazing because this has not been put in any form. It simply means that pion, low energy pion nucleon scattering, even though you need in the linear sigma model many, many, many orders in perturbation theory to produce it, comes out fine, because this is a statement about reproducing the scattering length for pion nucleon scattering in S waves, right, within this framework. But there is one thing which is particularly interesting here, namely, it's known for ages that this B naught is very small. And the driving term is really the next one, the isospin odd scattering length B1. So that number here comes out primarily from the B1 square term, not from this mean field term. So it's all fluctuations in a way in the language that we use. So it's a test to what degree of accuracy these fluctuations are actually generated in this functional renormalization group approach. And we can look at that a bit more closely, because not too long ago there has been a very involved chiral EFT next to leading order calculation of the in-medium pion mass. What's called B plus here is what I call B naught up to a factor of 1 over 4 pi and such things. But the point is indeed that the leading order, the mean field, the Hartree term is very small here, right? And basically all of the action here goes through this fluctuating term, the B1 term, the isospin odd scattering length squared, right? And this is what the functional renormalization group really reproduces very well. In fact, it goes, of course, in terms of picking up high order terms, it goes a little bit beyond NLO chi EFT. And so perhaps this is even a valid statement about convergence properties of the chi EFT at that stage. So this is a highly non-trivial statement. The final point I would like to make is about the chiral order parameter. Remember that we are dealing with chiral order parameters of basically two sorts, which are connected to one another. One is the chiral condensate itself, right, which is obtained by taking derivatives of the free energy with respect to the quark mass, or respectively with respect to the pion mass. And in the chiral EFT approach, this is what you do. You first calculate the free energy or the energy density, and then take systematically derivatives with respect to the pion mass. The other approach is to look at the sigma field as such, as it appears in the chiral nucleon meson model, because its expectation value by itself is already an order parameter with respect to chiral symmetry restoration or not. And here, these are these order parameters, and here you have what's called the leading order. The leading order is leading order in density, and that's where the pion nucleon sigma term drives the slope of the fall off of the magnitude of the chiral condensate. And you may have followed some of the discussions in recent times about this sigma term. There used to be a canonical value from the times of Gasser and Leutwiler of about 45 plus minus 8 MeV. It was never very well determined because it involves always taking a long, long extrapolation in the space of the pion nucleon scattering, low energy pion nucleon scattering T matrix. We used 50 MeV here, but more recent discussions lead perhaps even to 60 MeV or so. If that's the case, and if you would naively stay at leading order, we would see chiral restoration coming basically below three times, perhaps at twice nuclear matter density. And that makes you very suspicious, of course. But leading order is not enough, far not enough. And the fluctuations beyond that leading Hartree term really push the chiral transition to certainly high densities, right? I mean, you stop here at some place, but this would go on for quite a while. So nuclear matter, with respect to the question of chiral restoration, is stabilized on the density scale to some high density, probably 3, 4, 5, maybe more times nuclear matter density. This is great relief, because if this would have been the case, we wouldn't be entitled to do the nuclear many body problem even at 1.5 times nuclear matter density. Right? Okay, so this is one thing, and here we can look at this a little bit more closely. These are, again, these chiral order parameters plotted as a function of chemical potential. Here you have, again, the nuclear liquid gas phase transition. This is interesting. This is something that we didn't quite understand in the beginning, but Christoph Wetterich informed us with all his experience that whatever the order parameter, when there is a first order transition somewhere, you will see it in all other order parameters in all other channels, right? And this is really what happens. This is the chiral order parameter, and you see the liquid gas phase transitions in this. Right? And then it becomes stable. Remember, the first order one went down like this, and it stays stable for quite a while. Here is another way of looking at it. Again, symmetric nuclear matter. This is the TMU diagram. Here you have the first order liquid gas phase transition. And you look at the contour plots of the order parameter, the expectation value of the sigma field in the TMU plane. And nowhere in this surroundings here, in this whole area, do you see it go anywhere close to small numbers, right? It always stays above 0.6 or so. So from this, we conclude that there is no tendency towards a chiral phase transition for baryon chemical potentials, at least up to a GeV, which is already pretty high density, and at least up to 100 MeV in temperature.
Is the sigma really the F pi in medium, or is it?
Yeah. It is.
You have checked the axial current.
Yes. Yes. You check the axial current for, I mean, the transition matrix element.
And normally you would have two F pi's, right? I mean, space like time like F pi.
Oh yeah. Of course. I mean, this is one of them.
This is the time like.
This is the time like. Yeah. But that plays the role of an order parameter in this context. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. This, of course, is true. Yeah. Okay. Looking at it again from a slightly different angle, if you look at the effective potential once it is evolved into the infrared region where we really use it, it looks like this, right? As a function of the sigma field. Here you have the vacuum value, F pi. This is nuclear matter in its ground state. Call it sigma naught, right? This is the change of F pi at the density, ground state density of nuclear matter. If you change the chemical potential, you move this up and down. Right? So this is what you see here. This liquid gas transition range is what you see here in the order parameter, the sigma. And then comes an interesting point. many of the considerations of the chiral order parameter or the restoration of chiral symmetry in the past have been made at the mean field level. And if you do that by just turning off the fluctuations, you do in fact get a first order phase transition not very far above normal nuclear matter density. Right? This is about twice or 2.5 times normal nuclear matter density. But this is a fake, because if you turn on the fluctuations and the Pauli principle activities bringing in more and more repulsion at high density, you just stay at this level. Right? It's even more extreme in neutron matter. This is a plot as a function of density here rather than chemical potential. And again, if you do the mean field calculation, you see a chiral first order phase transition at about 3 times nuclear matter density. But if you turn on the full FRG, it stays and stays and stays, and not even at 8 times nuclear matter density has it yet reached the restoration point. Okay, so stability is induced by fluctuations involving multi-pion exchange processes with Pauli principle acting in intermediate states. Okay, just a few remarks about my favorite neutron star story. May I still do that? Yeah. Thanks. That's the key question. It's about the mass radius diagram of a neutron star, and that's produced by solving the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff equations. And for that, you need an equation of state, energy density and pressure as a function of density. And so there was a time before that red line here was drawn when people were absolutely freewheeling and choosing their personal equation of state and producing neutron stars as they liked. Right? Because in those times, still just a few years ago, the main body of neutron stars was around 1.4, 1.5 solar masses. And you see that you get those neutron stars basically with any kind of equation of state. May it be strange quark matter or nucleonic matter. But then the two solar mass neutron stars came along, two of them, and here is now this red barrier which you have to go through if you want to sell an equation of state. Right? And then it seems indeed that many of these exotic scenarios are simply ruled out. Right? Here are the two incredibly precisely determined masses of the two solar mass neutron stars. So the situation now looks as follows. I mean, it's not possible really to talk quark matter anymore, at least not in a bulk sense. It's not possible to introduce a kaon condensate at some point. All of that would make the equation of state much too soft in order to stabilize the two solar mass neutron stars. There have been very sophisticated analyses of what you need, and what you need is basically this red ridge here. And amusingly enough, a very old nuclear equation of state, the Akmal, Pandari, Panda, and Ravenhall one of 1998, really does the job. Right? Now, how do we figure in this context? Here it is. This is a chiral EFT equation of state, daringly, of course, extrapolated to something like 4 to 5 times nuclear matter density. You might not believe it, but then you come with chiral FRG, where you kind of trust even going to high densities, relatively high Fermi momenta, and it looks like this. This is the window of neutron star radii that's being discussed nowadays. I just came from a meeting in Seattle where Andrew Steiner has narrowed down this range of radii to about 11 to 13 kilometers now. And if that's the case, I mean, then there is another very interesting statement, namely, if The neutron star radius is 11 kilometers or larger, then you cannot have super high baryon densities in the center anymore, right? Star has to be large enough, and you cannot extrapolate to very, very high densities in the center. The typical densities that you get are not far, or are in the range of about 5 times nuclear matter density. But 5 times nuclear matter density is not a very large density anymore, right? If you think about nuclear matter itself in the ground state, there you have an average distance between two nucleons of about 2 Fermi. And now you go to 5 times nuclear matter density. And then the average distance narrows down not by a factor of 5, but only by the third root of 5. So you still have typically a more than 1 Fermi distance between the cores of the nucleons. And this is indeed where you might say nucleonic degrees of freedom are still active, right? It's not yet quarks that you see there. This is another way of summarizing the situation, a very interesting analysis by Kukkola and his friends, who links all that's known about the neutron or neutron star matter equation of state at lower densities to perturbative QCD at extremely high densities, right? I mean, neutron stars' central densities or energy densities are somewhere here. Right? And this is the green belt of allowed equations of state, and the chiral FRG really hits that quite well. Okay, this is just what I told. I mean, perhaps it's not so crazy to have nucleonic degrees of freedom still active in, even in the core of neutron stars. I mean, it's still up to debate, of course, because one can remember some really old chiral models of the nucleon. In those times, Andreas remembers that still very well. One talked about chiral soliton models, and in the more sophisticated versions of these soliton models, you had a core in the nucleon which carried, this is 4 pi r squared times densities, a core which carried the baryon number. These are the 3 valence quarks, right? They are really located in that core. And then there is the meson cloud surrounding that. And the charge radius of about 0.8 Fermi isoscalar here is basically made by the cloud. But the core radius is much smaller, about half a Fermi in size, right? And if that's the case, then even at 4 to 5 times nuclear matter density, the nucleons would still not overlap. You would have lots of polarization effects of the meson clouds. But that is what the chiral EFT or chiral FRG just treats properly, right? Dealing with these polarization effects. Okay, this is too much for now, although it's very interesting. And here is the summary. Well, I went through brief summary of the situation in perturbative KEFT to non-perturbative functional renormalization group approaches, symmetric, asymmetric, and neutron matter. Fluctuations beyond mean field are very important. They bring in multi-pion exchange mechanisms, low-energy nucleonic particle hole excitations. That's what we call many-body fluctuations. Both approaches describe the Fermi liquid to Fermi gas transition very well. And I think what's really most prominently coming up is that these fluctuations work against an early restoration of chiral symmetry in nuclear matter or neutron matter, baryonic matter at zero temperature. There is no indication of a first order phase transition coming up, at least up to 3 times nuclear matter density and 100 MeV temperature for nuclear matter, and at least up to 5 times nuclear matter density in neutron matter. And the neutron star equation of state is sufficiently stiff to, the resulting neutron star equation of state is sufficiently stiff to support two solar masses. And well, that's what I also mentioned, that there cannot be ultra high densities anymore in the core of a neutron star if the radius of the neutron star is larger than 11 kilometers, as one begins to believe it to be nowadays. Thanks.
Given the time, we'll just have a couple of questions.
Sorry for
actually,
not being
like
on time.
I'd like to get back to Andreas' question. If you write down that Lagrangian, which you start, I mean, it's a, you know, very interesting model, seems very consistent. But you get 100 degrees of freedom. And if you work not at high density, but if you work at low density, you ought to be able to reproduce the chiral Lagrangian, the EFT chiral Lagrangian.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And by choosing your G sub V and G sub T there, my question does it. You ought to be able to write an effective chiral Lagrangian and compare your your counterterms with the well-known experimental counterterms.
Right. Yeah.
And if the linear signal model is a reasonable depiction of QCD, then they ought to match. Now,
yeah.
I believe that they don't for the linear signal model.
Not unless you go to very high orders in the linear signal model. I think that's the whole point. If you do perturbation theory with a linear sigma model, you will never come close, say, at any of the leading or non-leading orders, right? This is why the non-linear sigma model is so much more efficient in doing this job. However, I mean, as you have seen, for example, in the pion nucleon scattering case, which is involved, low-energy pion nucleon scattering case, which is involved in looking at the pion mass in medium, right? You see that the in medium chiral perturbation theory result next to leading order, and this FRG result, this of course is a summation to all orders of the relevant diagrams. They come very, very close together. And so even though one can say the linear sigma model is not useful in doing a perturbative expansion of, say, the pion-pion or pion-nucleon S matrix, when you do it to all orders using such techniques, functional renormalization group, in the end, you come up very close to realistic results that you get from chiral perturbation theory. It came to us as a surprise also, because we had exactly the kind of questions that you had. We wanted to check it out. This is one example. I think if you go deeper into pion nucleon scattering or also pion pion scattering, you will find the same tendency.
I need to understand that better.
Anyway. Is it reasonable to say that regardless of what the low energy trip around the vacuum, what he's shown is that he can choose this special case, and that special case is sufficient to reproduce the full properties.
What do you mean by special case now?
As you guys were discussing before, that essentially the non-linear realization is a more general description of the symmetry than the terms that you reproduce.
If you carry the theory to sufficiently higher order. At a perturbative level, there is no one-to-one correspondence between the two.
I mean, I think that's interesting regardless of how it happens with low energy
matching. I would say so, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think if I remember right, some of the low energy comes from this L5 from the fourth order in L5-pi. They come out to be zero if you do the linear signal model. So this, you say if you do it some...
So some you get some fourth order constants.
D different.
Some fourth order constants, yeah, come out.
Yeah, so, some fourth order. No, I didn't say.
Not all of them. I mean, no, some of them come out pretty well already at that level.
That's true, but some of them are zero. So
some of them are zero. Yeah, they would
pop
up.
If you will do something.
That's my hypothesis at this point. Yeah, because we see good physics coming out when we do the full renormalization group and. Do resummations of whole classes of diagrams.
Could be also that these low energy constants are not relevant for what you are doing here.
Mm-hmm. Could also be.
It would be very interesting to look at the axial response.
Yes. Extracting GA would be a first good example for this. Yeah, absolutely. Pionucleon scattering as such would be interesting, right? Because it is a pain in the neck if you do it perturbatively in the linear sigma model. But as you have a tool here to go to summations to all orders, you may learn something. Right? In this approach, you would go to temperature zero, baryon chemical potential zero, and take a fourfold derivative of the effective action with respect to nucleons and pions, and you would see the pion-nucleon T matrix popping up. Right?
Okay, no other comments. Just thankful from